I am so happy to be here with you today. I really, especially just now, I'm very happy to be doing this practice with you because it just feels very, very valuable and important to me right now to be working at being part of the solution rather than part of the problem, of really being involved in a practice that leads to wisdom, to love, to compassion, to loving kindness, to harmony, to non-harming. It feels good. It feels as if it's a contribution, not only to us as individuals and to us as a group, but really to the world. So I'm so grateful. You give my life purpose. I'd like to start the talk with a quotation that many of you have heard me give many, many, many times. Please bear with me, but it feels important actually I want to read it in just about every retreat that I lead. It's the Buddha's words to the Kalamas. This, just keep in mind as you hear these words, that this was said by the founder of a spiritual tradition. Do not believe in anything simply because you have heard it. Do not believe in traditions because they have been handed down for generations, like Buddhism, for example. Do not believe in anything because it is spoken and rumored by many. Do not believe in anything merely on the authority of your teachers and elders, like the Buddha, or like the person who's speaking right now. But after observation and reflection, when you find that anything agrees with reason and is conducive to the good and benefit of one and all, then accept it and live up to it. I think it just turned itself off. I'll just keep going. So it's just in this tradition, you're really encouraged not to believe anything. Really, there's no credo, there's no orthodoxy, there's absolutely nothing that is required of us except the spirit of inquiry, except the spirit of actually finding out for ourselves what's true and what isn't. And I want to say this particularly this evening because this talk is going to be what my good friend Robert Beattie, who's another Vipassana teacher, calls sided. This is going to be a sided talk. I'm going to be taking positions. I'm going to be expressing opinions. And it's very possible that you will disagree with these positions and opinions, and it's absolutely fine. Just because I happen to be sitting up here doesn't mean that I have the truth. I just have opinions. And so if you find that the opinions are not useful to you, feel free to throw them out and ignore them. If what is said is in some way useful, then, as the Buddha says, you know, work it and see if it's useful. So with that caveat, so the first question is, what is this practice? And I think Shaila, when she was giving the instructions this morning at the first sitting period, summed it up in a very beautiful way. She said, the practice is awareness without judgment, which means that what we're doing is we're simultaneously applying mindfulness or awareness and loving kindness or acceptance. Awareness without judgment. We are aware of our experience, and then we're aware of how we relate to our experience. And if we find that we are in some way grasping at our experience because it's pleasant, or resisting our experience because it's unpleasant, to see if it's possible to let go of that grasping and that resistance. We're training the heart to be non-reactive, to have equanimity. We're developing a heart that is ready for anything. I love that formulation of the Dharma. We do this practice in order to develop a heart that is ready for anything. So if awareness without judgment is what we do in this practice, then the next question is, why is it important to do this? And for me, we do this to be free, because of freedom. Freedom not only for ourselves, but also bringing a certain level of freedom or liberation to the world. If we want to be free, this is what we need: to develop a quality of awareness or presence that is non-judgmental. It's not just the practice that we do in this retreat, in a retreat like this. Being in retreat is basically the practice ground, or the preparation ground, for the practice of our lives. And we take this out. We take this liberating practice out. So I'd like to read to you a story of a Vipassana practitioner who was applying this practice in a very difficult situation. It's been a real inspiration to me. Some of you may be familiar with this story. It appeared in the El Dorado Sun last June. This is an Israeli Vipassana practitioner who is involved with Tovana, a Vipassana meditation group in Israel that sponsored a peace walk in last April. Israelis and Palestinians walked silently together, being very mindful of each step through Jerusalem for peace. And just a little bit of background to what I'll be reading. Her name is Marion Pargamon. She was going to join the march, and so she had gotten to Jaffa Gate in Jerusalem in preparing to join the march when she ran into a very difficult situation. She found at a bus stop there was an elderly Israeli man and an elderly Arab man yelling at each other in intense conflict with each other. And the Israeli police came up, and she was very pleased to see that they didn't take sides, that they simply tried to bring peace to the situation. And she did her best to bring peace to the situation. Finally, the older Israeli man got on a bus at the bus station, and she was helping to calm the elderly Arab man. And things were sort of calming down. And then an Israeli woman came in and started screaming at the old Arab man. And so another intense situation. She was trying to mediate that situation as well as she could. The Israeli woman went and stopped a police car and got the police out. And Marion Pargamon explained to the police exactly what was happening. Again, they didn't take sides. That situation was finally calming down. And this is where I'll begin reading the narrative. Then, a Palestinian woman on her way to Jaffa Gate burst onto the scene. She jumps to the conclusion that the old Arab is under attack and rushes in a frenzy to rescue him. This is going to be a fairly long account. Please stay with me. She yells some insults at the Jewish woman, who is beginning to calm down, and the situation heats up again. All my attention is now focused on her. I feel she is like a bomb ready to explode. I try to explain to her what is going on, but she is furious with me, screaming out her hatred, her despair, and her pain. This is Palestine accusing Israel. At this moment, I represent Israel for her. This whole situation is greater than the two of us, and takes on proportions beyond our present meeting. She shouts out her sorrows about what is going on now in the territories. There was very bitter fighting happening at that time in the territories in April, the military incursions into Palestinian towns. She talks in particular about Jenin, where some terrible fighting is now taking place. She has families and friends there, and she says our soldiers are war criminals. She is convinced that we want to kill them all. Why do we hate them so much? They are not responsible for the Holocaust. Why should they be paying the price? She tells me about the refugees and their constant suffering, for which we are responsible. Pointing at the Jewish woman, she assures me that this Sephardi woman was treated with honor as a human being in an Arab country from where she comes, and look at how she behaves with Palestinians now. It goes on and on. She shouts and spews her hatred for Israel at me. I don't try to argue with her at all. Just notice the quality of presence and awareness and non-judgment, this quality of non-judging awareness in this situation. I don't show any reaction to all these accusations. I feel a huge compassion and an intense need only to listen to her. My patience is nourished by understanding that behind this overwhelming hatred is a deep suffering and pain aggravated by the present situation of war. It must express itself in some way so that healing can take place. I am ready to listen to what appear to me as the worst accusations, distortions, or calumnies, without reacting. I am aware that what reinforces my strength at this moment is that I have absolutely no doubt that the suffering and pain of the Israeli people is not less real and legitimate. I don't let myself get tempted or trapped into guilt or anger. I am sorry for the tragedy on both sides. My compassion for her is not on the account of the compassion and sense of loyalty I have for my own people, for myself. For me, this is not an issue of who is right and who is wrong. I feel very calm and peaceful deep inside. I know that it is the only way to calm her fury. I let her express herself for a long time without interrupting her. As she continues to shout at me, I tell her that she has no need to speak so loudly because I am listening to her with all my attention. At the same time, I find myself caressing her arm. She lets me do it and progressively lowers her voice while continuing to let her despair overflow. She says to me, "Do you understand why some of us come and commit suicide among..." "Among you? You kill us anyway, so why not kill you at the same time?" She even mentions the possibility of coming and blowing herself up out of despair. I tell her softly that I don't want her to die. Nobody should come to this decision. We all suffer on both sides. She goes on and on, claiming that the Zionists only want to get rid of the Palestinians. I tell her, "You see, I am a Zionist, and I don't want to get rid of you. I wish we could live together as good neighbors." She listens to me. She tells me about the demonstration that took place the week before near Ramallah. She complains about the Jewish organizations that took part in it. Then she asks me to donate some money to buy phone cards for Palestinians who need them. I give her some money. At this stage, the conversation is quite normal between us. She doesn't shout anymore. She is even able to listen to me. She is almost calm when I notice the people of the walk, that is, of the peace walk, approaching us slowly at the top of the street. They are in a line, 100 of them, one after the other, walking in silence, slowly, quietly, aware of each step, creating an atmosphere of peace and safety around them. They are very present. They radiate calm and warmth. I point them out to her and explain that this is the reason I came here, to join a walk of peace in which Palestinians and Israelis are together. I tell her about the walk, its message of coexistence and peace, peace at every step, here and now. I suggest that she come into the line with me. She hesitates and rejects my offer. At this moment, they reach us. Several people I know shake my hand warmly as they go by. A young woman, very active in a group of rapprochement between the two people, approaches her and gives her a kiss. It appears they know each other. I notice that she is very moved by the walk and the atmosphere it radiates. It seems to me calmer and calmer. Nothing like the furious woman I met only several minutes before. The end of the line passes us by, and I want to join it. Again I invite her, and again she declines. I tell her that I understand and respect her decision. Before I go, I tell her that I am sure someday we will succeed in building peace between us. She smiles and replies, "Me too." Then, to my total surprise, she comes closer to me and kisses me on my cheeks. She walks alongside the line for a while. She tells me that she likes this walk, that it makes her feel good, gives her relief, and that her mood is much better now. I am very moved. I feel overwhelmed by this encounter, especially by its unexpected ending. So here is a demonstration of awareness without judgment, of simply being present, and the healing power of that. Do you see how this Vipassana practitioner, developing herself in retreats and probably in a daily practice, manifests it in the midst of an extremely difficult situation? Imagine yourself in that situation. Imagine, you know, training our hearts to the point where we're no longer reactive, where we're no longer defensive, where we can be present for someone else's pain, even in the midst of enormous hatred and accusation. It's good practice. Awareness without judgment frees us because it deconstructs some very deep conditioning that we have. The conditioning, as I mentioned earlier, of grasping for and trying to hold on to what is pleasant in our experience and resisting and trying to get rid of what is unpleasant in our experience. In retreat, like this retreat, we can actually take this practice of non-judging awareness to very subtle levels. It's the deconstruction of old habits. So I know many of you know this information. Bear with me. It's the essential information of the Buddha's Dharma. But the Four Noble Truths: there is suffering in the world, there is a cause of suffering in our grasping for what is pleasant and our resisting what is unpleasant and our spacing out what is neutral in our experience. There can be an end of suffering when we stop grasping, when we stop resisting, when we stop spacing out. And there's a way to the end of suffering. And the Buddha describes in great detail exactly how we get ourselves into this pickle. In the 12 steps of dependent origination, I won't go into great detail with it, but just the important steps. So a sperm and an egg come together, and the human life begins. And as the material body begins to form, consciousness is present with the material body. As that mind, body, consciousness, and the material form develop, it develops senses. So we get ears, we get eyes, we get nose, we get a tongue, we get a body, we get a mind. Six senses in the Buddhist tradition. Once there's a body, a mind, and the sense doors, these organs of sensing, then what happens is that we have contact with the world. So there's a sound, and there's hearing. There's a sight and seeing. There's a smell and smelling. There's a taste and tasting. There are physical sensations and the knowing of those physical sensations. There are events in the mind, like thoughts and emotions, and knowing them. With the six sense bases and with contact, with every moment of contact, there is the experience of either unpleasant or pleasant, or neither pleasant nor unpleasant, neutral. Every single experience has that quality, one of those qualities. When the experience is pleasant, the mind grasps and clings because it wants to continue pleasant experience. When the experience is unpleasant, our conditioning is to try to get rid of it, try to get rid of what is unpleasant. And this, the Buddha says, is exactly where we start, where we create, and how we perpetuate our suffering. And in a retreat like this, you can just watch it happen. You can watch that conditioning play out over and over again. And what's beautiful about this practice is that at some point we realize, well, this doesn't really work. And so we come to a place of equanimity. We come to a place of presence that is non-judgmental, that is non-reactive. So, for example, just a little example. In retreat, you're sitting, and suddenly there's a strong sensation in the abdomen. So if mindfulness is strong, if the quality of non-judging awareness is strong, then there will be a sensation. It will be known. It will have a quality, unpleasant, and that will be known. And that's the end of it. Oh, sensation, unpleasant. Still there. Sensation, unpleasant. And you're with it until it passes. It's possible that the process may go a little bit further before you catch it. There can be the sensation, there can be the unpleasantness, and then there can be resistance. Say, fear may come up. You may notice that resistance and cut it there, cut the process there. If mindfulness and if the non-judgmental awareness is not strong, then there can be this whole reactivity and proliferation of thought. You know, we've all been there. So, sensation, unpleasant, painful, fear. Oh, I wonder what that is. Whoa, that hurts. Gee, maybe it's appendicitis. No, it's more likely it's cancer. Because grandmother died of cancer, you know, and it was colon cancer. And, you know, I really should have gotten that colonoscopy. And I've been putting it off for all this time, and it was really stupid to do that. So then there's self-judgment. You know, that was really dumb. I wasn't taking really good care of myself. And, gee, I remember grandma's funeral. And she looked so good, you know, they got her all fixed up. And that was the funeral where Uncle Zeke drank too much and then he wouldn't take a ride home. And I wonder if I'll be able to die with as much grace as Grandma did. I can imagine everyone sitting around me, you know, with my colostomy burping and I'm going to die with grace. You know, we could do this. And all of it, all of this proliferation comes from a sensation, and it was unpleasant. Do you see? That's how we free ourselves. We cut through it all. And if we don't cut through it, it's called papancha. It's called the proliferation of thought. What happens is that the emotional reactivity of fear feeds thinking, and then the thinking feeds the fear, and then the fear feeds the thinking. And that can go on for hours. It can go on for days. It can go on for decades, you know, with really powerful experience. So you see, that's exactly how we free ourselves. It's liberation. And it may not feel like a lot when you do it because it's such a simple event. Ah, sensation, unpleasant. Sensation, unpleasant. That's all that there has to be. This doesn't mean we don't take care of ourselves. If the sensation persists, then it's a good idea to go to the doctor and get it checked out. And maybe it is cancer and you'll deal with that. But do you see how the fear is actually projecting an event that you don't actually know about? Fear is always about a future event, something that doesn't exist. So this is presence, this is awareness that is non-judging, that is non-reactive. So the practice is really these two things. Whatever the sense door, ears, eyes, nose, tongue, body, mind. Did I leave anything else out? I think that's all of them. It's to notice what is happening in the moment, to notice its quality, whether it's pleasant or unpleasant, and then to notice how are you responding to it. Without judgment. It's not, we don't beat up on ourselves because we get caught up in this very deep conditioning, because it's been here our whole lives, and if the Buddha was right, it's been here for millions and billions and trillions and quadrillions of lives. He said there was no beginning to this process. So just have a little bit of patience with ourselves. But just to keep coming back to those two questions again and again as you do this practice. What's happening? How am I relating to it? And so awareness without judgment snaps the chain of causal conditioning. It breaks the chain. And each time we break it, we are doing a significant event for freedom for ourselves. So in retreat, we can really go to great depths and subtlety in working with these patterns of seeing that causal chain and deconstructing it. It's good to notice without judgment when we lose it. I've been losing it a lot in the last few weeks. I've been experiencing quite a lot of very intense pain in my life, and I can be with it up to a certain point, and then at some point the mind becomes reactive, and I lose it, and I get caught in just the process that I just described, of getting caught in proliferating obsessive thinking, a lot of delusion. But I actually don't judge myself about it anymore. I really see that when it reaches a certain intensity, then this mind can no longer hold non-judging awareness. It's okay. I keep coming back, just over and over again. Sooner or later, we'll cut through. This quality of non-judging awareness can be so helpful in our lives. Just one dramatic example. This goes way back to the 1980s during the civil war in Lebanon. Terry Anderson was a reporter who was captured during that civil war and was held for years as a hostage under very difficult circumstances. And eventually he was freed after years. And someone asked him after he was freed from this intense experience, imagine being stuck in a little room for years, whether he resented the people who kept him hostage. And he said, no, I wouldn't impose that kind of suffering on myself. He just let go. He let go of the resentment toward people who had caused him so much pain over so much time, because he realized that that would just simply be imposing more pain on himself. That's a liberated mind. You know, that's a liberated moment, at least. To be able to do that, and it really comes from this quality of non-judging awareness. I think the world, at this point, could probably benefit from a lot more awareness without judgment. When I look at our current global situation, and what I see is a lot of non-presence, non-awareness, and a whole lot of judgment. Imagine, just try to imagine that you lived in a country whose president is called Top Gun. It's Bush is playing Cruz. Reagan played Eastwood, do you remember? Go ahead, make my day. I actually look forward to a time, personally, I look forward to a time, I hope to live to a time when a president of the United States tries to play Gandhi instead. But the situation is very painful. It's very painful as we move toward war. And the Buddha is so very clear in his teaching. Hatred has never ceased by hatred. Hatred can only cease by love. And so as we see this cycle of hatred and violence in the Balkan states, it's been going on for centuries and centuries and centuries, the same ethnic groups, a cycle of violence and vengeance and violence and vengeance, and we've all been watching it in Israel and Palestine, especially in the last 2 years, but also going back at least a century among those groups. And we see the United States now locked in exactly the same pattern with Al-Qaeda and with Iraq. So last week the United States government sent a Predator drone, it's called, plane in Yemen and obliterated a car, and very pleased with themselves. And they announced this morning, or yesterday, it was announced in the news this morning, I heard as I was driving here, actually, the government is warning that Al-Qaeda has been planning some kind of very large, very dramatic attack on the United States in order to disrupt our economy. Do you think there's any connection there? You know, so this, it feels to me, with this kind of reactive mind, again and again and again, reacting with violence, it needs the same kind of cutting through that we're doing in this retreat, the same kind of slicing through of presence and awareness that is non-judgmental. So, if you know, just to compare the way people are locked in this descending spiral of violence and vengeance and war, to compare that with a story, a true story that that Jack Kornfield tells. Many of you may know this story of a mother whose teenage son was killed by another teenager, and she went to the murder trial, and at the end of the trial she yelled at this teenager, "I'm going to kill you," and he was off in prison, and he had no family, and nobody came to visit him, and she went to visit him. He was a little scared. She just hung out for a little while and chatted with him, and then she came back, and she came back, and she came back again and again and again, and forged a bond with this young man who had killed her son. And when his time in prison was over, she said, "I have room in my house. Would you like a place to stay in order to get yourself on your feet once you get out of prison?" And so he moved into her house. He moved into the room that her dead son had had. She helped him to connect to the community in ways that he needed to, work and school. And eventually she offered to adopt him as her son. And she said to him, "Do you remember how at the end of the trial I said I was going to kill you?" And she said, "I killed that young man." Imagine bringing that spirit to the situation that we're in, the global situation that we're in right now. It would be a different world. So I'd like to just suggest a couple of practices, a couple of other practices for developing this quality of awareness without judgment. We've described, you know, all day today, actually, we've described, and I've described in this talk, what we do in our practice in retreat, the moment-to-moment awareness of what is happening, noticing how we're responding to it, learning to respond to our experience without judgment, without reactivity, of developing equanimity. This is freedom. This is where the freedom comes from. We're going right to the source or the cause of our suffering, and we're removing that cause by doing this practice. But there are a couple of other things that you might find useful to do. One is to just simply, not only in retreat — this retreat would be a wonderful time for it — but really at any time in your life, is that whenever blame comes up in your mind, that is a judgment, whenever blame comes up in your mind, to see it for what it is and then release it, let it go. Blame toward yourself, blame toward others. I did it this morning driving here. I was driving south on Coors, and I got into a pack of cars that were behaving in a more dangerous way than I've ever experienced in New Mexico before. A lot of people driving much faster than the speed limit and doing really dangerous maneuvers. I don't know if everybody was late for work or what, but it was scary, you know. So I felt some fear at this stuff, and then some reaction, and I caught the reaction. I said, "Gee, that's not very skillful," you know, and just let it go. It's really, as soon as we catch that sense of blame, just to let it go, to see if it's possible to do that. It's a very powerful practice, very simple. And then you might also try a practice that a friend of mine has done for years and has found very useful, and I've actually started doing it more and more myself. And that is, anyone that you meet, notice that we have this response, we have this this preferential response in our minds with everyone. It can be very subtle, but to notice whether you are attracted to the person that you meet, or a little bit repelled by the person that you meet, or that you feel really neutral toward the person that you meet. Just notice that response. It's going to be there. It's going to be attraction, repelled, neutral. Once you notice that response, then generate toward them loving kindness. With a spirit of sending equal loving kindness to every being that you meet. I call it the equalizer practice. And it's just wonderful. It's a beautiful way of absolutely deconditioning that very, very deep conditioning that we have to grasp at what is pleasant to us, to push away what is unpleasant to us, to space out what is neutral to us. So you might try that. It's just really quite wonderful. You notice that response, loving kindness. And this loving kindness gets more and more powerful. Loving kindness is a completely non-discriminating practice. And so more and more there's a sense of sending love equally to all beings. It brings us to a place of deep equanimity. I'd also like to just mention what I find to be one other really valuable effect of really cultivating awareness without judgment. And that is to free us from the suffering that is caused by stereotyping each other in whatever ways. It's really quite powerful in that way. For example, you may know me as a gay man. If you relate to me as a gay man through the stereotypes of gay people, you will experience me in one way. If you come to know me as a human being in all of my complexity, with the particular history that I have, with the particular background and lineage that I have, you will experience me in a very different way. And so just really to be, and again, it's just letting go of the judgments that are involved, the separating judgments that are involved in stereotyping. Just one example that, something that happened to me last year, is that I was invited to lead a weekend retreat at the prison in Santa Rosa, New Mexico. And my friend Doug Booth invited me to come and co-lead it with him and with Father Dennis, the chaplain at the prison. And I said, well, who are you going to be teaching, Doug? And he said, well, they're mostly murderers. And I said, oh? And I said, Doug is a really tough, he's a tough lawyer. He's a sweet guy, but he's a tough lawyer. And I said, Doug, you're tough. I'm not. You know, I don't know if I could, I don't know. He said, just come and do it. And it was quite a powerful experience because, you know, you get to that prison and there's all this accordion razor wire and you go through layers and layers and layers and layers of security. It's just amazing. And, you know, with the big steel doors going clang behind you, I've seen it in movies, but then I was actually experiencing it, going deeper and deeper through the security of this prison into the chapel. And there were the murderers, all assembled. And it was an incredible experience, because what I experienced from them was not what I was expecting because of my stereotype of murderers. They were absolutely open. They were more open than any group of people I have ever experienced as a Dharma teacher. They were hungry for the teaching because they're in extremely difficult circumstances in their lives, and they needed these teachings and this practice for survival. You know, it wasn't a luxury for them. It was absolute survival, and it was incredible. You know, I can tell, you know, when I'm teaching, I'm talking to someone, it's like dropping a stone into a well, you know, and the stone will fall a certain distance and then it'll splash. It'll sort of hit the place where either there's resistance or there's non-comprehension. With these guys, it took the stone a long time before it splashed. So there was this very deep connection. It was amazing. So Robert, for example, Robert had murdered his wife in an act of tremendous anger. And his question to me was, can you help with me with my anger so I don't have to kill again? Right there, absolutely. I was so happy to help him with his anger. You know? there was a young man who had been part of a gang here in Albuquerque, and very, very warm, open, just absolutely wonderful human being, beautiful guy. And he had these two teardrops tattooed on his cheek, and I said, Doug, what are those teardrops? He said that each one represents someone he's killed. And so it was just very interesting. And it was, as we were doing the go around, someone introduced himself as Gordon, and I thought, gee, I wonder if that's Gordon House. Most of you, or many of you, maybe know about Gordon House, who was responsible for the death of a family. What a humble, simple, direct, open-hearted human being. So what the result of doing that retreat for me, making this very strong connection, easy connection, no work involved, was that I can no longer carry the same stereotype of murderers. It just can't come up again anymore after that experience, because I saw good human beings who were at some time in their life in difficult circumstances. I have certainly found the savage murderer in this heart, and I have just happened to be lucky enough to be in circumstances where that savage murderer hasn't come through. So I'd like to just end the talk by suggesting just reading something, and just to notice how the stereotypes fall away in this passage, and also this beautiful quality that people have of non-judging awareness with each other. This is from Ram Dass and Paul Gorman's book, How Can I Help? Shaila mentioned it earlier today. So I'm going to read three voices. First voice. So these boys moving around like waiters at a fancy restaurant, flirting up these old ladies, putting on their sweaters, reminding them of their numbers, they're playing bingo. These guys were heavy. I mean, heavy. Years of crime, dope, doing time. They're in a program called Prodigal. Last shot for rehabilitation. Miss this one, you're done. No more programs. And I bring them over here to the senior center to give them a chance to make that last step home by looking out for someone beside themselves. Because maybe the center's the last shot for some of the old folks, too. Last shot for companionship. Last shot before dying, alone. Both groups on the edge. Why not bring them together? So look around. There's so much life here, I think it's going to explode sometimes. And strange moments, too. Some guy comes up to me and says, that lady over there, she looks like someone I'd done one time. I say, go ask her if there's anything she needs. And he does. Second voice. I come to the center for company. I suppose older women like myself. But I meet these boys here. Very interesting, very different than I expected. This young man who walks me home, he's a very nice boy. His mother, she should be proud of how he acts with me. I know he's done wrong. Look, they did it to me. One kid once put a gun to my head and went for my diamond ring and wedding band. He bit my finger trying to get it off. But you know what? I wasn't angry. Maybe he never had any parents. Who knows what happened when he was very young? Who knows? I had some terrible experiences when I was young. Poverty and war. World War I. I was 10 years old. The Germans dropped bombs. A woman jumped on me to protect me. Her body was ripped in half. She saved my life. I was very frightened after that. I'm frightened now. But I'm grateful for life, although it's a little lonely. But this boy, he walks me home. He helps me with my groceries. He says, wear lipstick, a nice dress. You're very pretty. You should get married again, a nice lady like you. That man in the center, he wants to get married again. He's not good enough for me, I say. You're right, he says. Marry me. You're good enough, I say. But an old Jewish lady and a young black criminal. What would they think? I don't know what he sees in me to be so nice. All I know, he walks me home. We talk and joke. I learn things about how things are in the world now, which I don't know much anymore. And I don't get the feeling that I'm just a little old Jewish lady. You think that's nothing? You know how many other people I don't feel like a little old lady with? None. Nobody. That's the truth. How's that? Third voice. Try to shake having been a junkie and done time, man. Everywhere you go, you get that. That's who you are. But this woman, it's like she doesn't care. She says she had a hard life too. Maybe that's it. I told her how I robbed things. I told her about jail. She says, your mother must have been very upset. Let's get groceries. You have time to do that? Nobody ever treated me like I had anything to give, just to take. So that's all I ever did, take. Never knew my folks. Started in when I was 9. 4 juvenile institutions, 2 escapes, on the street at 12, dealt heroin, burglary. By 14, I had my own car and apartment. Got caught. Did a 3-year bid in prison. Had to stay in the hole because people tried to sodomize me. One guy stopped some other heavy guy trying to sodomize me and got cut bad doing it. Cut real bad. Only time anyone risked anything for me. This woman, she shows me something. I've seen jive courage, but she's brave, living all alone, being old. She doesn't recognize just how much she understands about life. Ain't nobody asked her questions anymore, so she forgets how much she knows. I ask her questions. I'm curious. She's interesting. We learn things together just looking around on the street. We have a good time, and I've done a lot of time. Old or young, no difference. I'm 25 and I feel old. My voice sound old on the phone, they say. So old people, I understand their situation a little. They're scared. I've been scared. They live alone, like in a cell. I lived alone in a cell. So this place, this attitude toward life they got going in the center, it's showing me some things. And this woman too. I'm not who I always thought I was, being with her, just walking her home. Her too, probably. It's like you're free for that period. I'm going to read that sentence again. It's like you're free for that period. I said, you're going to have to be born again. She said, that's not for Jews. I've done enough time. I've done enough taking. Time to be free. So the practice of awareness that is not judging is profoundly liberating. It's liberating for us in the moment as we do the sitting and we notice exactly how we're responding to our experience and we liberate ourselves, breaking the chain on a very subtle level. But it's also this quality of non-judging awareness is also liberating in the world. And there it can take us into very difficult situations where we can be present, where we can be listening, where we can open to pain without reactivity. It can cut through the stereotypes so that we're no longer projecting ideas onto people, but actually responding to people as they are. It brings connection in the world. It brings harmony. It brings peace. This is the way to true peace. It's not ever going to, we're never going to achieve it through bombs. So may we all find a way to come to deeper and deeper freedom through the practice of awareness that isn't judging. So let's sit for just a moment. For the sake of our planet and for the sake of all beings, may we all slice through our conditioning and be free. Thank you.